You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey, y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 185. Today's episode is all about dining and drinking in New Orleans. The last show was about a current exhibit at the Historic New Orleans Collection, all about the women's suffrage movement in New Orleans. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Before we jump in, let me talk about the people that make this show possible. Support comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection, the city's premier history museum, located at 520 Royal Street in the heart of the French Quarter. Check out their online publication called First Draft. It's a combination blog and online exhibition space at hnoc.org/firstdraft. Through November 5th, 2023, check out their exhibit about the women's right to vote titled Yet She Is Advancing, New Orleans Women and the Right to Vote. We just did an episode about it, in fact. It was the last episode, as I mentioned earlier. The 19th Amendment granted American women the right to vote in 1920, but Louisiana laws effectively disenfranchised black women. As many white women were going to the polls and increasing their political participation in segregation-era New Orleans, African-American women continued to fight for access to the ballot. From paying poll taxes to organizing voter registration drives, black women challenged their status as second-class citizens up to and through the passage of the Voting Rights Act. As always, the Historic New Orleans Collection is free. It somehow continues to fly under the radar, but you shouldn't miss it. Go to hnoc.org/visit to plan your trip. Longtime listeners probably remember the crew over at Two Chicks Walking Tours. They operate intentionally small public walks. The city allows up to 28 people on a tour, but Two Chicks limits their party sizes to 14 guests, 7 days a week. And they'll go out with just one person if that's all that signs up. So you could end up with it. You're going to have an extremely intimate experience no matter what, and you might end up with a personalized tour. Their experiences are focused on the Garden District and French Quarter neighborhoods. Two Chicks is also producing private curated walks for groups sized from 1 to 200. While the team is female-led, they do have a rooster strutting around, and there are tour guides from before the lockdown still on staff. Find out more at twochickswalkingtours.com. One more, James Cullen Photography. If you own a copy of the Beyond Bourbon Street Travel Guide, you've seen the work of James Cullen of Accidental Cajun Photography. Whether it's portraits, events, weddings, or lifestyle photojournalism, Accidental Cajun Photography provides quality and value. The reason I asked James to participate in my book, The Beyond Bourbon Street Insider's Guide to New Orleans, is that his strength, in my opinion, is capturing faces and expressions. James also offers photography instruction and sells his fine art prints at theaccidentalcajun.com. For inquiries, email him at accidentalcajun@gmail.com, and I'll put links to all that in the show notes. And now on to today's topic. Today is all about food and drink in New Orleans. It's been a while since my guest has joined us. Ian McNulty covers food and drink in New Orleans for NOLA.com and more, and we'll get into that. Hi, Ian. How are you?
Doing great, Mark. Great to be back with you.
Yeah, I think it's been since early COVID, so it's been quite a while since we've done this.
That's okay. Nothing has changed whatsoever. Nothing has happened in the interim. It's just been smooth sailing.
And thank you for joining this
absolutely,
podcast.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We'll close out now. I think you've actually been a guest 3 times, so that puts you and Richard Campanella in a tie, I think.
Right.
So
well,
pretty good company, both authors.
Food, architecture, maps. The geography, the culinary geography of New Orleans, it all fits together.
There you go. So maybe there's a book for you there.
Yeah, sure.
But I wanted to catch up on what dining and drinking looks like as we've, I guess, come out of COVID more or less.
Yeah, okay, yeah. I'm the same with you, Mark. Every time I say post-COVID or after COVID, I cross my fingers and my toes.
Someone gets COVID that you know, right?
Right, yeah, exactly. I say whatever phase this is of the pandemic. But we're clearly past the phase where restaurants and bars and businesses are under lockdowns and protocols are in effect, you know. And so, and that's the point. I describe, you know, the intervening years there as this undulating course for people in the hospitality business and people like you and I who follow it and love it and are moved by it and inspired by it, because we've all been there with it, right?
Yeah,
we've all been
right.
Watching it. And more than watching it, like it, as a avid pursuer of New Orleans culture, like we participate in the hospitality business.
Sure.
And so it wasn't just like this crisis, this was happening to places we were simply watching. It was the places that we interact with and we care about and we hope will be there and that we turn to. And so that hence a very intimate connection for New Orleans people and the lovers of New Orleans culture afar to these places as they went through it. And more to the point, the people behind them, because that's what it's about, right? So it has been this undulating course of ups and downs. And what I've learned just through covering it and talking to people who live it on the front lines is that it really isn't over. It is right now we're living through the phase of it that comes now, which is rebuilding, hopefully,
right.
Recovery, change. And it's been an extremely dynamic time in the business. There's been... Frankly, a lot of restaurants have closed or changed hands, often very surprising to me.
Yeah.
And other people stepping up either to take over those places or to take over that space and continue it with something different. And so it's been this highly dynamic, although not totally unexpected, season of change around here. And the reason I say unexpected, not unexpected, is because I was covering restaurants after Hurricane Katrina,
yeah.
And you know, there's no comparing that experience and that crisis to COVID for so many reasons. But at the end of the day, it was this line in the sand that mm-hmm. brought people to a lot of decisions. You know, after Katrina, it was, you know, you saw many, many places that could have returned. They could have rebuilt and gone on with it. But, you know, they looked at the way things stood and said, do I want to work all this much harder and invest all this money just to be back where I was the day before the storm? Maybe it's time to open a new chapter of my life, close this chapter, sell the business, sell the real estate, whatever it is.
Right.
And I've been watching that a very similar pattern happen as COVID has lifted and changed, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And so just, I mean, the inside baseball being a food writer, it means there's a lot to keep up with. And for aficionados, people who follow this all, a lot to keep up with, too. I mean, it's, you know, you always say, like, make a reservation and call to make sure your restaurant is open or whatever. Like, make sure that hasn't changed hands or closed down permanently. You know, I mean, that's the level of change that there's been. You know, but at the end of the day, it's not a wholesale change of the culture of New Orleans restaurants and hospitality.
Right.
It's a reshuffling of the players and some of the new ideas. And, you know, as sad as it is to see places close down, the upside always is new things coming along and new ideas and people expanding and new opportunities and teams growing and new chefs expressing themselves. And that's been really exciting to keep track of.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Hurricane Katrina. And of course, longtime listeners know my parents owned Teddy's Grill on Franklin Avenue. And my dad and mom were two of those that said, we aren't going to restart, simply because they knew it would take years and they didn't to get back to where they were at best. It was in Gentilly, which I would really say only until the last couple of years has become thriving again post-Katrina.
Right. Right.
And they made the decision, like many others, to call it quits. I think one of the things that's interesting to me about Katrina versus COVID, and maybe you'll agree or disagree, is Katrina, we had an influx of migrant laborers to help rebuild the city, and that brought with it a whole different style of food.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you still, that's a echo that you still can taste and see.
Absolutely.
Around New Orleans. It was pre-Katrina New Orleans, and now we're rewinding right. to 2005, right? Yeah, there was some Mexican food around town, and I don't mean, you know, Superior Grill. I don't
right.
mean Juan's Flying Burrito. I don't mean places like that. I mean, like...
There was
like,
Vaqueros.
Yeah, yeah. There's a handful of places that you would consider, like, a place you would find in Mexico. Like, this is Mexican food. This is a taqueria. Or a place you would find in Los Angeles or in Houston, you know? A handful of them. They're mostly in the suburbs, in the West Bank and
right.
in the Metairie Encounter. And there were no taco trucks, to my knowledge.
Right.
I mean, that was a foreign concept. That was something that you saw in other cities and thought, what is that, right? Well, Katrina hits. Very obvious there's going to be this massive rebuilding of the city. Construction workers flood in, and vast majority of them are from Central America and South America. And the food was fast on their heels. I mean, it was like this army coming in
yeah.
with the galley wagons behind the Roman army, you know. And it had an immediate change, an immediate impact, let's say, on
yeah,
New Orleans
definitely.
Food. It didn't change New Orleans food, but it added another level to it. So suddenly taco trucks are everywhere, which, as somebody whose house was flooded, I can tell you that was my salvation on many a, you know, bleach stained, mold covered rebuilding day, mm-hmm. was to go to a taco truck and get a brace of tacos and a lukewarm Corona and just slug that stuff back standing up and think, okay, this was the highlight of the day. Right. But from the taco trucks, a lot of people decided they were going to stay. I mean, new businesses were born, and along with that, a lot of new restaurants. And it added so much to the spectrum of Latin American food in New Orleans. Not just the taquerias, but right. Brazilian restaurants, Honduran restaurants, which has always been a strong suit in New Orleans, but just so many more now. Colombian restaurants. And it goes on and on. And it really, you still can see it and taste it today. It's exciting to go around and taste some of that stuff. And it's here to stay. I mean, it's not just the restaurants and the taco trucks. The number of Latin American markets, groceries,
yes,
has exploded. And that just reflects the population change.
Right. I mean, and so now that's almost, you know, essentially a generation now that we've had that part of New Orleans that really, as you said, didn't exist. What to you was different? As we, again, I'll stop saying it, I guess, but, you know, we go through COVID and now here we are in 2023. What do you think is different about this recovery compared to the recovery after Katrina?
Well, I mean, we can talk about the COVID impact of endlessly, because it really was this huge thing, you know, in everybody's life, of course. Uh-huh. Everyone you talk to around the world was impacted in some way. But in the hospitality industry, it really was on this front line of it, not in the way that healthcare was, mm-hmm. But in a way that, you know, many people could just switch gears to working at home, and it was very different, right? The hospitality industry is not like that, right? So it was a full dead stop, and then how do we maneuver this? How do we try to get through some of this? And like I say, it was very closely watched because we were participants in it in a way that we were not necessarily participants in the legal industry, the accounting industry, you know.
Right.
You know, you intersect with those, but it's not as immediate as where are we going to dinner on Tuesday night, honey, or where are we going to go when we come to visit New Orleans because we want to go eat and drink, right? So yeah, the recovery of this has been different because it was not physical destruction, you know.
Right.
I mean, we lost a lot of people. We lost a lot of good people that I can think of individually in the hospitality industry who, I mean, just going to say it frankly, they died from COVID. I mean, that's a brutal impact. But overall, for the industry and the culture, what it was everything stopped. We had to think about how things were going to restart. And in many cases, this is the first time that these places had actually stopped, not counting a week break in the summertime,
right,
or something,
right,
like this. But when you stop the machine and let it settle and then get the gears going again, a lot of rust comes along with that, or B, you see things that you can do differently as you start ramping up. And so there's been a lot of change in the way restaurants operate and how they're sourcing things. You know, things have gotten more expensive.
Yeah.
It's a knock-on effect from, like, further down the supply chain. Everything they're being charged for by their vendors is more expensive, and that does show up.
Yeah.
And so it does kind of change the value proposition a little bit. Like, if even your casual restaurant is going to be a little more expensive, at least a little more expensive, why are you going? What's it all about? And so, you know, the savvy restaurant operators recognize that. They're like, I have to charge this amount of money for a hamburger and a beer these days, so how do I make it worth your while, you know?
Yeah.
So it's about doing things a little nicer, a little better, so that you feel as the customer like, okay, yeah, this was better eating at home. There is a value to this. And I mean, the other thing, this is a little harder to quantify, but just talking with people in the business, as I do constantly, there were two parallel things. There was exhaustion and sort of a breaking of morale. Everything was a challenge. Everything was so much harder. Everything was so much more expensive. So how do you find the spark again to get up and do it every day? Maybe you do change things to make it more engaging for yourself, or more compelling, or more, this is my life's work. And on the other hand, there was sort of a, okay, we almost lost everything. We mm-hmm. tasted what it was like to not have this part of our culture. So yeah, we're coming back. No, we're not losing this, not on my watch. And so, like, a redoubling of mm-hmm. of the effort, the enthusiasm, the passion for it. And you do see that. And like I say, that's harder to quantify than menu prices. But you see people who are like, okay, this is, do I have 20 more years left in this business? I'm going to give it all I can. Is this my time as a young chef, as a 20-something, 30-something chef, to start my own restaurant, to take a risk on this concept that's important to me? Yes, it is. And so the number of chefs that I've talked to who have become restaurant owners in the last couple of years, bringing their vision. Maybe it was a pop-up before. Uh-huh. Maybe it was something they did on the side while they worked at another restaurant. Maybe it was the idea they had in their back pocket for someday. Well, someday came very quickly for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Almost simultaneously. So a lot of people who had, you know, I'm thinking of Chef Charlie Pierre. He runs Free Thai Restaurant. Uh-huh. Right? This is a Haitian restaurant. And he always had the idea that he wanted to run a restaurant based on his heritage as a Haitian. And he was trained in modern American cuisine. He's worked at high-end restaurants, but he came through a family of first-generation Haitian immigrants, and he's very connected to that culture. So, by the way, we're in New Orleans, which is a... yeah. You know, very closely related. I mean, this is almost a sibling relationship with Haitian food and Haitian culture. So, a lot of links through culture and history. So, you know, if not here, where? And it's got to be right now because this is my time. And so, you know, it planted this amazing Haitian restaurant in the Treme, which that idea was not. It was certainly on his mind, but it was not in the works until the spur of this. And that goes on and on and on. Like, multiply that example many times over.
And I think one of the real challenges and one of the things that made places like that possible are that we went, while we were in COVID, we went through this period where either they weren't open or it was takeout only or was outdoor, right? I mean, we're sitting here on a near 100-degree day at Port Orleans Brewing, and a special thanks to them for allowing us to record here. They created an outdoor space that, not on a day like today, but on a lot of days is really nice, and that space didn't really exist.
Oh, that's a great point, Mark. That is a big change that is now basically mainstream, but rewind it like a brief period, like a couple of years, like that first COVID summer. Yeah, there had been this growing thing in New Orleans of outdoor spaces, you know, Bacchanal, which is this outdoor wine hang, basically. It was a restaurant built around a big backyard. You know, a few places like this were coming along or had established a track record and shown it was possible. But really, you know, New Orleans gets very, very hot, and you know, hope this isn't shocking to people, it also gets very, very cold sometimes in the wintertime, you know? And so outdoor dining was definitely not the norm.
No, not at all.
It became a necessity in COVID. And honestly, as an observer, I was watching to see how it would go. And I figured that first summer, okay, people were desperate to get out. When things first started opening up, yes, you can eat outside now and restaurants can serve outside. The weather was nice, frankly. It was late spring, and the weather gods were conspiring to make it like the nicest spring I've seen in my time here. And yeah, so it made a lot of sense. But okay, what happens when we get into the teeth of June and July? Like, how bad is this going to be? And like, is anyone going to be want to do this outside when it's really hot? And also, there's flash downpours all the time. The summer, like the summertime, just downpour just happens.
Right.
But you know, Mark, like I was surprised. People really took to it.
Same.
You know? Yeah. And it not only that, it lasted. Like, it has become a permanent part of the way people design new restaurants now and retrofit older restaurants. People want that outdoor dining space. And yeah, you know, 1 o'clock in the afternoon with the sun beating down on you, there's not much you can do about that. You really don't want it. But I mean, I'm here to say, even on a really hot day, by the end of that day, when evening time rolls around, if you have the benefit of an umbrella and some fans blown around and you're dressed for it and you have the right mindset for it, you know, you're not wearing a cummerbund to these dinners, okay? This is not tails and tie. Keep the taffeta at home, ladies. But the if you're prepared for it, it actually is quite pleasant. And you know what? It feels tropical, and New Orleans is tropical, and sometimes that just feels right.
Yeah.
So people have embraced it, and restaurants have been designing and building in infrastructure around it. And it's made possible restaurant and bar spaces that you never would have seen a few years ago. Not in this city.
I think about Val's on Ferret.
Great example.
Which opened right early on in COVID. It's an old gas station and an old-time gas station, so a very, very small inside.
Yeah.
They actually do have a tiny bit of inside dining, but when they opened, they had no inside dining, and they did it through fans and those sales and just kind of clever outside. And you're right, except for the hottest of days, you could go, and it was packed almost from the day it was open. It continues to be packed.
Right. Yeah, it's along Ferret Street, which is kind of a restaurant row uptown, very far beyond Bourbon Street.
Right.
it's near Tulane University, Loyola. after Katrina, there was nothing happening there whatsoever. Right. And then, you know, it slowly and then suddenly quickly became this restaurant row. So it's packed with dozens of restaurants and bars. Mm-hmm. And it's a great feel because it's very multi-generational. There's like the college students all go there, but sort of their parents or their grandparents, sort of people like you and I.
Yes.
And it's this really nice mix of restaurants. Like you can kind of go and like shop by your appetite, whether it's if you want pizza, there's like deep dish pizza from Midway. There's Neapolitan style pizza from Ancora. There's tacos at Val's.
You have
there's
Hi-Hat.
Tacos at La Sarita. You know, there's Hi-Hat for hamburgers and good like plate food and gumbo and stuff. So it's all over the map and it's always changing. There's always something new kind of cycling through. But what it didn't really have was much outdoor dining.
Right.
Dat Dog is this hot dog and beer place. They had a big kind of beer garden, you know, a hot dog place. It makes sense, right? But most of the real estate around there, the built environment, were these small shops.
Mm-hmm. Storefronts right on the
street. Yeah, you know, an old bakery here, an old house turned into an office there. And so what Val's did was planted right in the middle of that restaurant row this verdant oasis of tropical plants. And that's part of the key is like make the outdoor space appealing and nice. And it's tequila drinks. It's tacos. Chef Fredo Nocaria does a great job there. It's very accessible, but also it feels very genuine. It's not just cookie cutter like Mexican food or something.
No, you know? it's
a
several steps up from that.
At least, yeah. And actually, the tequila and mezcal selection there is one of the best in town, I'll say. And you see it like it becomes this energy point for Ed Street, and that's and that's an example that you see again and again and again at different places around town, different parts of town. It'll be some place that like just brings the outdoor stuff and people flock to it. In Mid City, there's a number of places like that. In fact, one corner, it's on Bienville Street, just off of Carrollton Avenue. So that's kind of the main drag there in Mid City, and this is close to City Park, kind of close to where they do Jazz Fest. There's Klessy's Seafood, which is a boiled seafood place, which is mostly outdoors. Again, like you said, the Val's is an inside, but the
it's
action is
outdoors.
Outside.
Yeah.
And to me, that feels like what it's the closest thing it's like to go to a backyard crawfish boil or a shrimp boil, which is the way that most locals do it, you know?
Right.
And so here's a restaurant that makes that available for you to just walk up to. And then right next door to that is a restaurant that's called Monday. That's the name of the restaurant, Monday. And yes, they're open on Monday. Thank goodness for that.
Right.
But that's this up-and-coming restaurateur, Larry Morrow. He started that. It had been an existing restaurant. He took it over and really accelerated it. And it's a scene. It's mostly outdoors. There's a little bit of indoors, but everyone wants to be outside. There's always a wait, and people love this place. And a big part of it, yes, it's the food. It's like a mix of Creole and actually a little sideline of Korean, because Larry Morrow's family is African-American and Korean, and he combines those in the menu. But it's a whole lot of the atmosphere, and it's the vibe that they set, and it's the way that it's the kind of space that people just want to inhabit and be in. Even in the summer in New Orleans. And as mind-blowing as that was, and as like you would not have bet on that a few years ago, it's playing out for sure.
You're right. And that's a place in its initial creation, and then with Mondays taking over, it was built as an outdoor establishment. You're right. Nobody goes there to sit inside.
Right.
You go, and they have done a marvelous job of making it comfortable outside.
Right. And it's just like Val's, it's an old filling station.
Right,
you know?
Right,
this,
right.
This was an auto shop, but still, it's something about those rolled-up doors that just gets restaurant people thinking like, oh, we could take this over and dig out the gas tanks underneath and turn this into a hospitality space, you know? But I'm here for it, you know?
Yeah.
They dot the different neighborhoods now, and it's one of those things when you drive by, you don't have to wonder like, oh, I wonder what's going on in there. You see what's going on. It's right there on the street.
Yeah. I mean, right. It's great advertising. And I was surprised, like you, I mean, this was a city, I know you're not from here, but you've been here a long, long time. This was a city that was almost like, gosh, it's too hot. But we're used to wearing linen and seersucker and light clothing anyway.
Yeah.
And 99% of the time, it's really pretty nice. I don't know, like tonight, you'd have to wait pretty late because it's hot.
Yeah.
But this is unusually hot even for us. So a lot of times it's pretty nice and it expands seating space.
And there's something about the character of the city. I mean, New Orleans is a subtropical city. So you know, when it's wintertime here, it's usually pretty pleasant and nice, and that's when I think, oh yeah, I made the right move coming down here from the New England winters of my youth. I don't miss those at all. But every once in a while, it gets really cold, and it mm-hmm. just feels wrong. You know, it just feels like we're getting the raw end of these things here. Like,
yes.
Summers are really hot. The winter is supposed to be universally nice, but now here we're stuck with almost freezing temperatures, and it just doesn't feel like the character of New Orleans. But when it is hot and languid and things slow down a little bit, and yes, people may be glistening with sweat and half drunk, but that's the way that some people try to end the night. That's the way we start the night, okay? That's just the starting blocks for us in New Orleans. And there's something about the banana trees and the palm fronds, mm-hmm. It's hot, it's languid, have a drink, relax. That is New Orleans. So if you're gonna be here, you need to come to peace with the heat. And part of that is you don't have to, being glistening doesn't mean you have to be uncomfortable.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of that in Jazz Fest, right? I mean,
sure.
It's almost always French Quarter Fest, you sometimes get lucky and you have really nice spring weather, but certainly by the second week of Jazz Fest, that's almost unheard of. And so there is this thing here that we're used to it. As we're talking about things expanding, let's talk for a moment about some of the losses, some of the things that we did lose in COVID that have gone away.
Well, I mean, the biggest one to me, and it was an early loss, was K-Paul's Louisiana Kitchen.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, if they knew not much about Louisiana or New Orleans food, they've heard the name Paul Prudhomme. He was the one who put Cajun food on the map for people back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. I mean, worldwide. And really was this huge ambassador of Louisiana cuisine and culture and inspired countless other people. Like, you don't get Emeril Lagasse's success without his predecessor, who was Paul Prudhomme, right? So that's just the way it goes. And, beloved character and true worldwide ambassador for New Orleans and Louisiana. Well, he died a few years prior to COVID, and his family was running the restaurant. And this was, this really was the restaurant that started it all on Charter Street in the French Quarter. And, it's like we were talking about at the beginning. Like, it was decision time for people about what they were going to do with businesses. And in this case, they decided, maybe we would have run this a few years more, but we're shutting down. And so they shut down and put the restaurant up for sale, and it's since sold. Yeah. The building's changed hands, and there's a new concept going in there, which is going to be sort of a casual brunch cafe bakery kind of idea called French Quarter Boulangerie. Not open at this recording, but we'll see how that goes. Okay. That was the one that frankly shocked a lot of people.
Yeah,
because
definitely.
If K-Paul's can close, anything can close, mm-hmm. right? Another one that I would put in that ilk, it's far less known outside of New Orleans, but very, very important and beloved inside New Orleans, Upper Line Restaurant. Mm-hmm. Joanne Clevenger has been running it for generations, really, family restaurant, and she decided, I could probably reopen again, but it's one of those things. You stop the engine. The locomotive grinds to a halt. And not just for a weekend or a week vacation or even a month, but that stretched on for several years. And she permanently closed. She's in her 80s. And, she's very happy with the decision, but also misses it. And I hear that from a lot of people, and who make that kind of call in the industry. Because, it makes sense to do that. But that's how people are hardwired, to be in this business, to get up and do the things that they've been doing the whole time. So that was a big, that was a classic, what you'd call a modern bistro. Not old like the Galatoire's, Antoine's, Arnaud's of the world, but, dated to the 80s and really was this capsule of itself.
It was
this emblem of itself. And no one is ever going to replicate that. The building at this recording is currently up for sale.
Yep.
But no one's ever going to open a place that it was exactly like that because it's a personality-driven restaurant.
Right.
One more that comes to mind. This is out in the suburbs, but a lot of people know it, Andrea's.
Yeah.
It's an Italian restaurant of long standing, again, been around for more than 30 years. Chef Andrea Apuzzo, again, personality, real character, And if you live in Metairie, which is, the suburb adjacent to New Orleans, you pass by it on the way to the airport. It was a very important restaurant for that community. And, he sold it, and once you do that, it just becomes a piece of real estate. What's going to happen to it? So, and then in between that, countless little mom and pops, and one that still sticks with me that I really wish was still around is a po'boy shop called Avery's on Tulane.
Yeah, yeah.
And you, Mark, you grew up in a po'boy family. Mm-hmm. This was a place that was newer. It only started, maybe 10 years earlier. which, you know, in other cities is a lifetime for a restaurant, but in New Orleans, yeah. But it had the soul of a po' boy shop that had been around forever. And Justin and Christy ran it. It was a family affair. I just loved the way their way with po' boys. It had its own distinct flavor, but it was true to the classics. And, you know, they just couldn't find a way through the pandemic, and they closed. And every time I drive by it, I miss it a little bit, you know?
And it just seemed like, so Avery's was on Tulane Avenue and was in prime position for, since Katrina, we have a new VA hospital and a new LSU University Medical Center, which took the place of Charity. It seemed like it was just hanging on long enough to get those open, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And then
that was the idea.
It hit a moment where you had all these new white-collar employees working there, right?
Yep.
And it was booming. But then again, I think they just looked up and felt like, can you start again?
And that's the thing, Mark. You can't underestimate the personal stake of it all. Because it's not just, do the numbers make sense? It's not a widget business, right? It's not just a transaction business of like, okay, this financial deal makes sense, so we're going to go over here and do this. It is a heart and soul business. It is a hands-on, prepping the food, meeting the people, you know, dealing with the headaches that come through it, being encouraged by the gratitude and the connection you feel to it. And all that was just stressed to the limit through COVID. And I say to people all the time, we love our mom-and-pop restaurants, but because they're mom-and-pops, they are fragile. You know, they're vulnerable to all the things that can happen to a family. Think about your own family. You know, are there divorces? Is there illness and even the death? Is there new children joining the family? You know, all these things that can change your outlook and the texture of your family.
Sure.
Imagine that playing out through a restaurant, through a business that is very demanding, very rewarding, but very demanding.
I'm thinking about Little Dizzy's as you say that.
That's a great example too. Right. So that's one that we almost lost.
Right.
Right. So Little Dizzy's
is came back.
The epitome of the Black Creole Soul Cafe. It's on Esplanade Avenue. It's in Treme. It's a couple blocks out of the French Quarter. And it's not that old itself, really, but it's the continuation of this family line that goes back into the 1940s. And think about that. A Black-owned restaurant, family legacy going back into the 1940s during segregation, right? So to carry that through that span of history, that tumultuous span of history, very significant. And like I say, it wasn't one restaurant. It started with Eddie's in the 7th Ward, and then this is the Baquet family. They had restaurants all over the city, not all at once, but they would move the concept around and open it under a little different name. It wasn't like it was restaurant empire, but it was the continuity of it. And usually named after the latest child or grandchild, right? And so, Zachary's, and then the Little Dizzy's. The Little Dizzy's is named after one of the grandsons who was his nickname was after Dizzy Gillespie because of the way he played trumpet in the St. Aug marching band in high school. And so, like I say, the epitome of a family-run Creole restaurant, and the gumbo, the red beans, the fried chicken, kind of place you walk into, and there's tourists for sure. There's also New Orleans police brass. There are people, if it's a Sunday, who just came from church. There are, state legislators and city council people shaking hands and then going outside to talk. There are cupped hand cell phone conversations going on outside the restaurant. It's an integral part of its community. And it also happened to be run by a man, Wayne Baquet, who's getting up there and was looking ahead and was like, okay, can I reopen in COVID? I don't think so. I take this very seriously. I feel vulnerable. What do I do with my business? Is the next generation very successful in fields that were not hospitality? They went to business. They went to other fields. They had their own things going on. And so they said it was closed and it was up for sale. And I wrote a story about that for the newspaper. And Mark, wouldn't you know it, they told me that they started hearing from people from every direction, and that the outpouring was so heartfelt that it changed their hearts. And so the next generation, Wayne Baquet's son, he and his wife, we have all this other stuff going on, but we have to keep this going. We have to find a way. And so now Keisha Baquet, daughter-in-law of Wayne, she essentially runs it day to day now, and it is the next generation that took it over, and it's back, and it's beloved, and it's bustling, and it's wonderful, and it's a great place to visit, like I say, in Treme, right outside the French Quarter, for like a totally legit taste of this piece of the New Orleans cultural spectrum, which is a bedrock one, frankly. I mean, Creole cooking is as real as it gets.
Yeah.
Get and the gumbo.
I promise we'll move on to a happier topic, but I think the other piece of this was and continues to be the lack of labor.
Yes. Yeah. Well, again,
and the increased cost when you do find labor.
Yeah, shut the machine down, start it up again. Things are different, right? I mean, yeah. You have staff. You know, restaurants have a lot of turnover. It's just the nature of the business. Some restaurants in this town are known for the longevity of their staff. The waiters right. and the cooks and the chefs have been there for generations. I've seen generations of people come through, bartenders too. But, you know, in general, it's a business that people stay in for a few years and then maybe go do something else, you know? Right. And it's an easy place to pick up a job. It's probably a hard place to build a career, yeah. but it's the kind of thing that can happen. But all that turnover happened instantly. You know, it's that instantaneousness of it, right? Mm-hmm. Everything shut down at once. And so for a lot of people who thought, yeah, I'm going to work in this restaurant or this bar for a few years and then do something else. Well, that then do something else happened for everybody, right? So sure. are you going to go back to school or are you going to move from New Orleans? We have a lot of people from other places here, myself included. You got to move back home. Is your time done because of this crisis? Is it time to start your own business? Is it time to get into the family business? Is it time to get into real estate? Whatever it was, you know, that happened to everybody at once. And so it was this long, slow rebuilding. And I'm happy to report that that has settled down to a great deal. No restaurateur I talk to is fully staffed or is like, oh yeah, things are fine. But it is much more manageable now. Now it's a matter of like, okay, if we had, depending on the scale of the restaurant, you know, 10% or 5% more people, we would be really smooth sailing. Whereas before it was, you know, we're down to, I've got cousins coming in here. I'm working 7 days right. a week, you know, 15 hours a day kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's been hard. And like, you know, and people came back and they saw the value of what they do. They were in demand. They demanded more money, as well they should. And you know what? That shows up on the bottom line, the receipts. That shows up of what we pay as consumers. It's all connected. You know, yeah. you can't separate one from the other. Like, oh, this is good. We stand up for restaurant workers and support this, but also why the restaurant price is so expensive. It goes hand in hand.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the end of the day, it's people's living. You know, people need to make money.
Yeah. We're a tourism-based economy here, a service industry economy. It stands to reason that it should go up, but it is a shock for people. So you get both sides of that, right?
That's right.
As we move on to more positive and about some of the neat things that you've seen coming out of COVID, I think that, yes, it's gotten more expensive. Yes, people have to adjust to that because that's going to get passed along to the consumer. But the most important thing I would say to a listener is it necessitates something you said earlier. Always, always, always call these days you go someplace because of shortages. And that's getting better. I think restaurants are getting more comfortable in their staffing and being able to open certain hours. But even as somebody that is immersed in this, like I am, I can't tell you how many times I've showed up and found a place closed that didn't used to be closed. It's stabilizing now.
Yeah. Now, you know, if you make a reservation, you know, whether it's through one of the apps, Resy or whatever, or OpenTable, like, you're probably going to get a notification. You're probably going to get a heads up, you know, that kind of thing. But the more casual neighborhood places that don't take reservations, which we love, you know. But, every once in a while, something like that will come through as a surprise. A lot of them will be pretty diligent about posting something, maybe on Instagram or Facebook, whatever they use. But yeah, don't take it for granted that every place is going to be open. For a while, the big dynamic on that, Mark, was restaurants just had to pick a day to be closed, you know? And for a lot of people, that was Monday. But then they noticed that with so many places closed on Monday, if they were open on Monday, they did pretty well. So maybe let's close on Tuesday or Wednesday. So it was sort of this moving target, right? Yeah. So it's not universal. And, you know, for visitors, that's often something because, you know, people who are making a long weekend of it or here all week or here for a festival, very often they stay Monday.
Sure.
And then, you know, maybe they leave Tuesday.
Right.
Flights are a little cheaper. You know, they get to enjoy the whole weekend or however long the experience is. And yeah, so like, where do I find a restaurant open on Monday? You know, that became a big hunt for a while. But that it has stabilized a little more. But yeah, to avoid disappointment, you know, use a little diligence. You
particularly
know?
The casual places.
Yes, indeed.
You know, if you have a reservation, you're going to be good to go. But now, okay, so I have taken you down this path for 25 minutes of doom and gloom. Let's talk about some of the exciting things, some of the places that are on your radar that have opened in the last year or that are about to open, things that you're pretty, you know, just jazzed about having come on the scene.
Yeah. And there's a lot of it. I mean, we touched on some of it. It's the idea, like I mentioned, the Fritai, the Haitian restaurant, of people like putting their ideas into action, of doing it. You know, the city is full of this stuff right now. And I've been doing, in my coverage, if you follow me on NOLA.com or, you know, on my Instagram handle, Ian McNulty NOLA, you'll see what I try to keep is a mix of what's new and also sort of what's enduring. It's endearing and enduring. It's endearing because it's enduring and vice versa. But I've found revisiting places that have been around for quite some time really resonates with readers because they share these memories of places and they like kind of revisiting with them and going back to them. But that has been this pulse of new ideas and new places coming along. And, you know, a few what I would highlight, there is, right now, tasting menus are having a moment in New Orleans, and that doesn't mean the same thing everywhere. Like Emerald's Restaurant, we talked about Emerald earlier. Emerald's Restaurant is now a tasting menu-only restaurant, and it's, I don't want to quote the price because I think it changes, but it's quite high. You know, you're going to pay a lot of money there. This is a special occasion outing for sure. But it's really, really good and special and nice. But now take that same model of, you know, tasting menu, you walk in, you not pick off the menu, you are in the chef's hands, and here's what they're serving this week or tonight or whatever. That's taken a lot of different shapes. There's a restaurant in the Bywater called Saint Germain, which you could pass by 100 times and not know it's there. It's a shotgun house, an old cottage. It used to be a pizza place. The sign for the pizza place is still up. You have to look at the little letterboard sign, you know, stickered onto the door, the window of the door, to see the name Saint Germain. Well, this is a fantastic place that uses only a tasting menu format. They've changed it up a little bit here and there on the number of courses, but suffice to say, it's going to be this progression of small tastes that are exquisitely done, and there are flavors that you just don't see coming. Like they use a lot of, this is a highly manipulated, and I mean that in a good way, like a very technique driven menu. And some menus focus on simply the freshness and the, you know, let the ingredients speak for themselves. We're talking about a restaurant that uses techniques that you are not, you're not doing this at home, right? This is not like you got a nice piece of fish and it's fresh and let's cook it. This is long fermentations, smoking something, kind of transforming the nature of something. And so it teases your palate and you think it's one thing and it turns out to be the next. And I say all that, Mark, and it's not the molecular gastronomy. It is not head scratching. It is delicious. And it is also very engaging as an experience. So it's like going to theater and dinner at the same time. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, there's a restaurant, Mosquito Supper Club, which is a tasting menu restaurant that feels exactly like eating at somebody's house with the screened-in porch in the back and the shared black iron pot of gumbo and the ladles on the table and everything else. And that is Cajun food, specifically Bayou Cajun food, which is very different from prairie Cajun food, high Cajun country food. This is down low, down the bayou Cajun food. Melissa Martin is the chef there. She's from Chauvin, Louisiana, which is as down the bayou as you can get. There's not much further down the bayou from that.
And she's come out with her own very successful cookbook.
Yeah, won a James Beard Award. Right. Yeah, the same name, Mosquito Supper Club. And yeah, what she does there is very unique. And especially as a visitor, that's a taste of a place that New Orleans people, frankly, mostly would have to travel, you know, an hour and a half away to experience back at their grandmother's house on the bayou, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so then that's a chef tasting menu, essentially. They don't call it that, but that's what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one serving and it's communal and it's very casual. It's very different from Saint Germain, extremely different than Emeralds, but the same idea. And so a couple more in that vein, Lengua Madre. This is Chef Anna Castro's very personal lens on Mexican cooking, and it is not what you're thinking of when you think about a Mexican restaurant, and it's done in the chef tasting menu format, and it's proven very, very popular, highly engaging, and that's been something that we didn't see before. There were restaurants that had chef tasting menus, but the different ways that people interpret that and serve that and make that their own has been pretty exciting. So, you know, a few more that have come along recently that I've been really excited about. This is on the same tip of places closing and that being very sad and often heartbreaking, but then seeing what comes next. There was a restaurant in the French Quarter on Rampart Street, so right on the edge of the French Quarter, that I loved through the years, called Mobar. That closed in the pandemic, and it was a lot of people were shocked and saddened by that. It's since become a new restaurant, different operators, called Mamou. This is Chef Tom Brannigan. This is named after his grandmother, whose family nickname was Mamou. And it has nothing to do with the town in Cajun country of the same name. Absolutely nothing to do with that, I promise you. It is refined, modern, stylistic French and Creole cooking. Not French Creole, but French as in something you would find in a modern bistro in Paris, and some touchstones to Creole cooking here. First-class wine program, and Mark, it's small. It's intimate. It's this jewel box of Art Nouveau detail and design, and it's one of those, like, okay, this is why we're dining out. This is why we're plunking down the cash for an upscale experience. It's highly distinctive. It's personality-driven. It's beautiful. It's not what you're going to get at home, I promise you that, and it's exciting. The presentations are beautiful. The flavors are engaging. And just, you know, another one I've been high on lately, this is down in the Bywater. So again, like, you know, getting out of the French Quarter, going on a little journey. It's called Bar Brine. And for a long time, this place was called Sneaky Pickle. And it was a lunch place. And it was good. And it was really good, actually. And it was all about, you know, seasonal local harvests, but done in this very accessible, casual kind of way. Order at the counter. A lot of vegetables, but not to the exclusion of whatever a great fish was or a really good burger made with beef from local Louisiana ranchers, that sort of thing. Well, during the pandemic, they had a lot of challenges themselves. There was a fire, everything. But they came back and really doubled down. And so now it's a dual concept. It's still called Sneaky Pickle during the day, but at night it's called Bar Brine. They moved to a different location, very nearby, but much larger. Very cool, modern space that some people may remember from back in the day. It was called Maurepas Foods.
Yeah.
It was this place that sat empty for years. You always wonder what was going to come in there. And that building is living its best life as Bar Brine. So if you go at dinner time, it's Bar Brine. And it's fantastic. The cocktails are great. It's a stylish setting. It's very relaxed and casual and stylish. It has a good energy and buzz to it. And the food is... It's not explicitly Creole, or you're not like, oh, this is New Orleans food, but all of it comes from local sources, and so that is the epitome of what this is. It's just run through a different lens. It's a very friendly place for vegetarians or people with some other diet considerations like that, without excluding a really good fish or really good meat dish.
Yeah.
Fun, exciting place.
Totally, I agree with that. And we've lost a couple of the vegan friendly places. Seed comes to mind.
Seed,
probably
that was
the most
all
popular,
vegetarian,
all vegan.
Yeah,
right.
You know, and that's a request that I hear from a lot of people, especially people coming in from town. Okay, we know about all the big name places, none of which are vegetarian or vegan. I mean, this is New Orleans. That's not the basis of the cuisine. But things have changed. Okay?
Yeah.
Like when I first started reporting on food down here, if you were looking for a restaurant that was meatless, you would call up and say, not even a restaurant that was meatless, excuse me. You're looking for a restaurant that served meatless dishes that you could bring someone to who was vegetarian or vegan. You'd ask, do you have any meatless dishes? And they'd say, oh, yeah, sure. The catfish, the oysters, the shrimp. No, that's not what we mean. Although there is the argument that oysters could be considered, take that one way or the other. But now even restaurants that are, serve the full broad palette of things have not just accommodations for vegetarians and vegans.
You're not going to get just a vegetable plate or pasta.
Pasta primavera, the dreaded pasta primavera that every vegetarian who's been doing this for more than a few years and learned to hate back in the day. A place that comes to mind, also a new place, very exciting, place I love. It's called Le Chat Noir. This is downtown in the CBD, very close to the French Quarter, but it's on St. Charles Avenue, but in the business area of it. It's next door to Herb Saint, very well-known, very popular restaurant from Chef Donald Link. But this place, Le Chat Noir, is the upscale version of a very popular casual breakfast brunch place called Bearcat.
Yeah.
So if you want kind of the casual, anytime, might have to wait in line for it kind of thing. That's Bearcat. There's a location downtown, and there's a location on Ferret Street, which we just mentioned. And if you want the upscale full show, it's Le Chat Noir. And again, not explicitly vegetarian or vegan, but a menu designed with all diets in mind. And that includes wonderful fish and meat dishes, but also some of my favorite dishes at these restaurants on any visit are going to be vegetarian and vegan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. So we've been going a while. I got a bunch of questions. We'll try to jump through as many as we can. So we start off with questions from our patrons. So those are supporters of mine that contribute a few dollars a month in order to help keep this going. I haven't read these ahead of time, so we'll see what we get.
Okay.
And Jeff's...
Full disclosure, me neither.
And if we've covered them, we've covered them. Jeff Singer asks, what trends in local dining deserve more attention than they're receiving? I think probably the tasting menus at the various price points is one.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, that was one that leapt to mind for sure. I think the diversification of styles of food that still qualify as New Orleans, right? Like, so New Orleans has this sense of identity that's we're fiercely proud of, mm-hmm. and protective of, defensive of, right? And even sometimes, like, aggressively defensive of, you know, like, don't mess with my gumbo,
right.
Okay? But what I've been seeing is restaurants that feel very New Orleans to me, but have a different interpretation of what that means. And it's not cookie cutter, it's not a template, it's not what they're doing down the street. But to me, it still feels very New Orleans. And I love to see that because it's very often New Orleans people or people who have lived here long enough to really be invested in it and have skin in the game and know what they're doing who are putting their own signature on the place and the flavors that they love. And not just a twist on gumbo or something, but like, how do I make a New Orleans restaurant that tastes like what I'm experiencing?
Yeah.
Great example of that, Palm and Pine.
Oh,
okay?
Yeah.
This is also
good
on Rampart Street in the French Quarter. Young, modern restaurant, very stylish. It's upscale but casual. And their own tagline is south and south of that, meaning like that's the food that they serve. So it's highly New Orleans to me, but not to the exclusion of the Caribbean, a little bit of Texas, a little bit of Deep South. And that's what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
This is not, they may have a gumbo on the menu, but this is not a fried seafood platter, po' boy, gumbo kind of place.
Right. Yeah. They are best tagline around, in my opinion, because we refer to ourselves as the northernmost point of the Caribbean, right?
Yes.
And they have captured that really well.
Yep.
Donald Tatera asks, what are some of your recommendations for the best happy hours in the city?
Oh, okay. Yeah, this is great. And I'm probably going to go with more the restaurant happy hour, you know, because, a lot of places will have dollar off your drinks or whatever. Well, on that note, look for places that have the reverse happy hour, right? Because this is a 24-hour city, right? And so we have a lot of bars that are open around the clock. And sometimes you'll see a reverse happy hour advertised where it'll be happy hour from 4 to 6 a.m. That is not like to accelerate the person who's been drinking from 8 o'clock at night and is still up at 4 a.m. This is for the people who got off of work
service
at
industry.
4. Yeah, and it's their happy hour now. Thank you very much. But the places that I'm thinking of are restaurants that have really good deals on the food and the drink. And it means you have to start the evening a little earlier. But hey, I'm here for that. No problem at all. Okay. There's a place in Mid-City called Blue Oak Barbecue. I think it has one of the best food happy hours in town.
Yes,
it's a barbecue
definitely.
Place. Yep. And it's, you know, it's the small plates, the appetizers, things like that. Really good deals on those and on the drinks. Dominica and Pizza Dominica are two very closely related concepts. Dominica's more of a full upscale Italian restaurant. Pizza Dominica is its pizzeria sibling. They have fantastic deals on pizza, I think half price, and on wine and other drinks at the bar. And again, that's an early start. The one that I went to last time, I think it started at 3 o'clock and ended at 5 o'clock. But, you know, if it's the right day, weekday, and you're getting in there, go for that. And then oyster happy hours are a cool thing, too. Luke is a restaurant downtown. I think they're doing dollar oysters still. You know, some of the details on this stuff change depending on what the season of the market is. But Superior Seafood is another one. It's on St. Charles Avenue. They always have a happy hour for their oysters. Very good deal. And, you know, a place like that, you just make a destination of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, without a doubt. So this one's going to be a challenging one for you as a food critic.
Bring it on.
Mark Wingfield asks, can you think of a time you had a negative experience at a restaurant on your first visit, but were very pleasantly surprised when you gave that same restaurant a second chance?
Yes, and I mean, this probably is not surprising. The restaurants get better as they develop, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, there used to be a standing, not a standing rule, but sort of a rule of thumb or basic good guidance for someone who is going to rate, assess, you know, consider a restaurant, give them a few months, right? But that doesn't happen anymore. It doesn't happen in my field, and most people
so
I know,
fast.
They
want to
get in there, right? And it's just the pace of information. People want to know. They want to know what's
everyone's
going on.
Everyone's got an Instagram account with an opinion.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And frankly, everyone's a critic now, you know?
Right.
Which, you know, if you follow me, and it's fair, people say, you're not really a restaurant critic. I agree. I tend to... if I'm going to do a whole story on a place with photos and everything, I'm here for the places I think you should go to. I'm there to uplift. I'm there to say, like, I go everywhere. This place has really come to my attention. I'm grabbing you by lapels and shaking you and say, go there. But, okay, to answer the question, yes, you go into a restaurant and you can see the potential of it. You can see where it's going. And they probably do need to sort a few things out. And the ideas that the chef thought were going to be killer prove impossible to execute at speed. The staff just can't do it. Or more likely, nobody wants it. the particular dish, you know.
Right, of
course. If that's the whole concept of going out of business. But, you know, given even a matter of weeks or months, a place grows into itself. And I even see that with restaurants I really like in the beginning.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
There's a restaurant you can see, oh, they're off to a great start. But A, it's so popular and so busy, it's not doesn't really have a chance to be itself. Give it 3 months, it may feel like more of its full self.
Yeah. I try to hold off, but I'm with you. It has gotten harder and harder to do that because people can get information from everywhere,
yeah.
Credible or not, right? Everyone's got a Twitter account or an Instagram account or
right.
Something, and people are going to give opinions. And so if you wait 6 months, which was the old sort of, you know, you'd wait 3 to 6 months, now you're sort of behind the times and people are saying, why haven't you gone? Why
right.
haven't you tried it out, right?
Right.
And having grown up in the restaurant business, I know, even a casual place, it takes time to figure stuff out. And with food costs, too, that's another thing that, you know, that really a chef may want to execute a dish and it just becomes untenable. He can't mm-hmm. he can't plate it for the price that he can sell it
mm-hmm.
at.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he's going to make a decision. I think you've answered this one, but Ashley Bonas asks, I would love your take on what may or may not be considered typical, but is can't miss food experience. I think the place you were talking about, the tasting menu place, and I've now drawn a blank.
Yeah, Mosquito Supper Club.
Well, Mosquito Supper Club.
Oh,
with the,
yeah, St. Germain on St. Claude
Avenue.
I think
is a great example of that.
Yeah, that's a good example. But here's one I would throw out there for you is don't discard, you know, especially for visitors, the takeout experience, right? There's a lot of places in New Orleans that are integral to what we consider a kind of our food life that aren't really restaurants. They're
right.
corner stores, they're markets. You know, during crawfish season, which is in the spring, that's especially true. But a lot of places that do crawfish, they shift over to shrimp in the other seasons. If you are mobile at all, you know, you go to a place like this, you get some boiled seafood and some beverages or po' boys or whatever, and you go to City Park, you go to mm-hmm. Audubon Park, you go to the Bayou St. John, you go to what we call the Fly, which is the waterfront, yeah. the riverfront part of the park by Audubon Park, by Tulane University and Loyola University. And you just have your own sort of self-guided picnic with boiled seafood or po'boys or whatever. That's going to be a totally authentic, legit, what locals would do New Orleans experience that revolves around food that didn't happen to be in a sit-down restaurant.
The Fly is a great example. You get a nice view of the sunset. You get a nice view of the river traffic. You can smell kind of the brininess of the river.
Yeah.
The two places I think of for something like that are a place like Bevy Seafood, where
right.
you get boiled seafood to go. And now I am, again, drawing a blank. There was another one that comes to mind that we do often. But Po' Boys is a great example. Oh, Zimmer's.
Yeah, Zimmer's right? and Gentilly.
And Gentilly,
right.
not
yep.
far from my old, right next to John Gendusa's, who's one of the few French bread producers left in the city.
Yeah, making not a French bread that they would recognize in France, mind
no,
you, but the bread
po' boy
that's
bread.
Integral to Po' Boys. Yeah,
yeah
that's right.
So.
And Zimmer's is very close to City Park, which is
the lakefront.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, right between them.
Yeah, so there you go. Let's see. I think we have answered this, but I'll repeat it. Hollis Hurd, how is the service industry faring 3 years after the pandemic? Ian talked about that.
Yeah.
Is New Orleans back to pre-COVID in terms of employment, restaurant hours? I think so.
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah. Yeah.
We have more restaurants than we had before, I think.
I think the replacement rate has been greater than the closure rate. You know, I see new places, new buildings turning into restaurants that never were before. Old
yep.
places get snapped up. So, yes, and yeah, hours and there's no restrictions
right.
on restaurants. Yeah.
This one I'm going to mention, you did answer it, but you know this person. So I'm going to mention it. Chris Marshall. Best choices for vegans and vegetarians, is Laguna Madre as good as I think it is?
Yeah, Lengua Madre is, yeah, that's the Mexican tasting menu restaurant. It's not vegetarian.
Right.
I hasten to add.
He's got two questions there.
Okay, okay. So, yes, it is very, very good.
But
you know, it's a unique experience. It's, you know, you're going to spend some money on it, especially if you get the drink pairings, which I think you should, you know, if you're going for the full thing. You're there, you know, you've already bought in, do it. It's an experience kind of restaurant. These tasting menu restaurants are not the any night kind of thing, right?
Right.
There are, you know,
special occasion.
Yeah, special occasion. Or if you're in town and this is something, you're curious about. You are putting yourself in the chef's hands, so, you know, see what they do, right? And so vegan, vegetarian, you know, I mentioned Barberine.
Yeah.
Carmo is another one that kind of flies under the radar, but is this wonderful tropical restaurant. That's the best way I can describe it.
Yeah.
A lot of South America, a lot of Southeast Asia, a lot of that sort of Ecuadorian belt that goes around the world. That's where they draw their food traditions from. And not just vegan, vegetarian, but people who have other specific dietary issues, and whether it's allergies or whatever, like, very accommodating.
Yeah, good job.
And more than accommodating, it's built into the program, right?
Yeah.
It's not a special thing.
Yeah.
It's not a talk to the chef. It's noted on the menu. Bearcat Cafe, the casual version that we talked about. And listen, if you want to have what New Orleans people consider like a little corner store soul food kind of experience that's completely vegan, this is a place in mid-city called Sweet Soul Food. It's on Broad Street. It's not a sit-down place. They have tables, but it's a counter service.
Yeah, I wouldn't think of it as a sit-down place.
Yeah, you go through and you get a tray of food. Right. Yeah, and it's a takeout box of food from the hot lunch line, basically. But it's gumbo, it's mac and cheese, it's fried chicken, none of which are meat. It's all done with vegetable and plant-based stuff.
Yep. Joe Sweeney says, or asks, what are the best Creole restaurants you found outside of New Orleans? And then he goes on to say, I'll give you a moment to think about that, because he says, I'm a fan of Alex Patut's food. I have it shipped and keep a freezer full at all times. What else would you recommend for great Creole food reliably shipped? That's a tough one.
Yeah, okay. Well, first of all, the Creole food outside of New Orleans thing, why? I mean, when I go outside
Creole
of New Orleans, I don't want Creole
Cajun
food.
Cajun, are you?
Yeah, right. Like, even so, outside of New Orleans, if you're just talking about the rest of Louisiana, it's very different, right?
I mean, yeah.
Cajun and Creole are very different animals, and if you go to Cadiana, those are Cajun restaurants. It's different from the Creole, French Creole tradition that we have in the city. And so personally, when I travel outside of New Orleans, I'm not looking for a take on New Orleans food. I'm just not.
No.
And I mean, yeah, there probably are some reasonable facsimiles of it. But when I travel anywhere, I'm looking for what is meaningful locally. Now, there's a lot of great restaurants in the rest of Louisiana. And, you know, forgetting further than that, you know, we can get pretty deep in the weeds. But for shipping, it is actually an interesting era for that because of COVID. During COVID, a lot of places that never considered shipping before found out that it's practical. They can make some money on it. There's a demand for it.
Yeah.
And so one that comes to mind is Dookie Chase's.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't get more Creole than that. This is, you know, we talked about Little Dizzy's and the Baquet family. This is a nearby restaurant, a very different tradition. This is the Chase family. Leah Chase, the queen of Creole cuisine. She passed away a few years ago. Her funeral lasted a week. That's how beloved she was.
Right.
And her, you know, her fourth generation of that family now is continuing it and uplifting it, actually. I mean, they're doing great things. And they just started shipping their gumbo and other orders. I mean, certain things that ship better than others, right?
Sure.
Gumbo's one. Yeah. Parkway Bakery, they ship their po' boys. I've sent a few of those to my mom through the years. She loves that. Napoleon House, they'll ship their muffaladas. Central Grocery, that's the famous place for muffaladas, not open right now in its storefront
location.
So they've
had to rely on out-based places and shipping.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Hurricane Ida did a number on that on the structure that Central Grocery had, and so they are rebuilding, but still not open as a storefront, but there you can still get their muffaladas here locally at stores that sell them separately, and also you can get them shipped. So Gold Belly is a good resource for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite costly,
right?
But it, you know, because they tack on their own fees and everything, but you know, for if you need a fix, it's cheaper than a plane ticket.
I also think about Vaucresson's.
I think he's
now shipping. I think he's either now doing it or imminently going to do it. One, he's opened his own cafe again, which had been years in the making. But they also, I think, will ship their sausage. And they have several new variety of sausages. I think at either French Quarter Fest or Jazz Fest, they introduced a Jamaican jerk sausage.
The jerk chicken.
Which is delicious.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, I had several of those at Jazz Fest. This is the longest running vendor at Jazz Fest. A lot of people know him from that. Vaucresson, he's reopened his cafe and a butcher shop there on the 7th Ward on St. Bernard Avenue. It's fantastic. And that guy that you want to talk about dining experience, just ask him a question.
Yes.
And it's like press and play. You know, Vance Vaucresson is the man.
Vance has been on the podcast. I went to high school with him, my brother Martin. Yes, a just living history of the 7th Ward and of the Treme and Creole culture. If you want to know the difference between Creole and Cajun, go in there with 2 hours to spare and ask Vance that question. Just a couple more, because I know we need to wrap up. I'm going to screw this name up, but Archana Austin, what are New Orleans' most classic and our storied restaurants, and that could be a whole episode, and which ones continue to live up to their reputation? gosh.
Okay, well, I mean, she's talking about the French Creole restaurant. So, yeah. The oldest names, Antoine's, 1840. It's the oldest restaurant in New Orleans, which is saying something. It's also the oldest restaurant in America continuously run by the same family. That means there's other restaurants that are somewhat older, maybe one or two, but none that have been in the same family. We talked about family businesses and family restaurants. Think about keeping that going from 1840, okay? There's been a few changes. Arnaud's restaurant, also family-run restaurant. Huge, sprawling restaurant.
Great place if you're going to have a special event.
Oh,
looking
yes.
for a nice room and an upscale place.
It's like a night of the opera, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
it's wonderful. You can just explore the place. Galatoire's restaurant. Toujac's restaurant, quite old, but is in a new location now. It's a very different restaurant from what it had
been.
It is. Yeah, it's a very different restaurant. But getting outside of that, I mean, it's not necessarily the age either, right? So on one end of things, I would say Clancy's restaurant, deep uptown. I believe it's been around since the 80s, so I mean, it's not exactly the new kid on the block, but when you're comparing it to 1918,
it's still 1840, as good as it's ever been.
Yeah, this is one of my top five restaurants in New Orleans, Clancy's.
Get the veal enunciation.
That's a great call. Deep uptown by Audubon Park, and it feels like a real find. It's an insider's kind of place, and this is a very good picture of what Creole cuisine is with very strong old roots, but also a little bit more of a modern eye to it. It's not quite as, this is the way we've always done it and the way we always will do it, of the other places. And on the other end of things, well, I'd say Dookie Chase's qualifies for this too, multi-generation Creole restaurant of a different tradition. And like a place like Mandina's restaurant, right? This is Creole Italian, so it's a different take on Creole, but it's definitely Creole, but there's also a lot of red sauce.
Definitely New Orleans.
Been around since 1930-something, and Cindy Mandina's running it now. Again, multi-generation kind of place, as vibrant as ever.
Yep, and the one I would add to that, and listeners, again, have heard me say this many times, is Brightson's.
Oh, sure.
Chef Frank has been on the show as well, but we took my parents there just the other night. You know, again, not old line, like 100-year-old restaurant, but he's been there 35 years, I think he just celebrated.
1980s, yeah.
Just classic and inventive as well.
Right,
so
exactly.
You'll
get a real taste of New Orleans flavor that you can only get in that restaurant.
Yes, and some of the best sourced seafood around. If he's got a fish dish on, he's got the best suppliers that I know of. If he says it's a special, it's fresh caught that morning.
Well said.
And he won't put it on the menu.
It's just a little cottage restaurant. Yeah. You really feel like you're home there.
Quickly, a couple from our Facebook community. Nathan Norsworthy asks, what are the off-the-beaten places that are exciting and different? I think you've hit those.
Oh, I mean, a few of them. I mean, there's countless. I mean, Bar Brine,
I think that's really worth checking out if you haven't.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, head up to Mid-City, right? I mean, like, Mid-City is a vibrant neighborhood. It's deep New Orleans. It's very accessible to visitors. And you can go around there. Laius is by the track. It's this little kind of hole-in-the-wall tavern.
Yeah.
With excellent food. You know, it's the kind of place you'd hope to stumble into in any city you're visiting.
And if you've been to Jazz Fest and gone through the main entrance, you've walked right by it. You just may not have realized it.
Yeah, that's right.
David Kimberly says, can you ask Ian about the influx of non-native chefs and how that impacts the indigenous cuisine? I heard Eric Ali talking about this. I think you did talk about that, really. That goes back to Katrina and then ever since, right? We've always had an influx. I think about Emeril, right? Or Paul Prudhomme, even.
Yeah, no, that's true, though. I mean, those are, Paul Prudhomme's from Louisiana.
You don't think about it, but not from New Orleans.
Not from New Orleans, yeah, right. Which is, believe me, like, if you're Paul Prudhomme's from Ville Platte, Louisiana. Opelousas, Louisiana. And like, if you're in Opelousas, Louisiana, and you say you're from New Orleans,
no,
you are talking about two different places,
and
right?
Emeril Lagasse is up from your part of the country.
So there is, I get it. Like, it gets back to that idea of this is our identity. We're protective of it. We're defensive of it. And so, yeah, you don't want someone landing here from somewhere else and like saying they're gonna. Let me put it this way. Anybody who lands here for somebody else and says they are going to show New Orleans a thing or two about food is picking the wrong fight. But what I love to see are people who do come from other places really get it, absorb it, add their own personality and identity to it, because that's why food and restaurants matter, is when it does have a sense of personality. And that's going to be a little different if you grew up in Gentilly like you, or if you grew up in, let's say, St. Lucia, like a certain...
yes, well-known chef.
Yes, certain well-known chef. Who has Compare Le Pen and Bywater American Bistro. I'm talking about Nina Compton, of course. She's a runaway success who totally gets what the New Orleans food thing is and does her own. She's not making gumbo, right?
Right.
She's not making po'boys. She's not making trout almondine. right? She's making food that corresponds to the Creole identity from her lens coming from the Caribbean. And I love that. I'm here for all of that.
We have just more variety than we've ever had.
Oh, that's absolutely
without
true.
A doubt. I think we have a fabulous Ethiopian restaurant.
Yes. Yeah.
Just moved into a bigger space.
That's right. Addis Nola. Yeah, it's on Bayou Road. That's well worth the trip. I mean, talk about a family that, I mean, they're serving very traditional Ethiopian food, but every once in a while they work in something like there's a shrimp dish that they do that's Gulf shrimp, but done with the Ethiopian spices, the berber spices, and a little bit of local honey. Really bright, spicy, delicious. Just, yeah. And, you know, and a lot of it comes down to the intent and the. And the respect that is paid to New Orleans, and, you know, the best places get that.
Yeah. And one more, and then I'll let you go.
All right.
Liza Jax says, not a question so much as a comment about what I see in New Orleans, and I'm loving more with every visit. Fabulous bar culture combined with elevated food programs. I'm thinking of Sylvan and Will and the Way, for instance.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. And I'm here for that, too. I sometimes, like, you know, as a food writer, you don't want to put too hard of a label on a place. Is it a restaurant? Is it a bar?
Sure.
A lot of places that'll open up, like, they don't actually know. They'll tell me, like, well, I think we're mostly a bar, but we also have really good food. And you know what? The customers tell them what they're going to be. And
right.
Very often the answer is, you're a tavern. Okay? The two places that she mentioned, those are taverns. You know,
yeah.
It's a place where you're going equally for the food or the drink. You're at home doing either one of those things, but it's totally worthy of going there for dinner. Also, we're going there for just drinks or drinks and snacks. And yeah, I like seeing that. Those are both two places in the French Quarter, happen to be run by the same operator.
Right.
Probably not coincidental.
No.
Good eye for that kind of detail. But yeah, there's more and more places like that. And I think it splits the difference between, you know, what people want. You
yeah.
know, they want that casual atmosphere.
Bouligny Tavern comes to mind.
Bouligny Tavern's a great idea. Actually, I was just in there the other night, and then we were sitting back and wondering, like, what, is this a restaurant? I mean, it says tavern right in the name. And I'll put it to this way. Everybody was having cocktails or wine. About half the people were having food, and that felt about right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's it. There's a local, I'll call him restaurateur, but that doesn't begin to define him, Robert LeBlanc.
Yes.
Who is a master at this, I think.
Well, that's Sylvain
right.
and The Will and the Way
right.
and a few other places.
He's working on a place in Nashville right now.
That's
in fact,
right.
he's going to come on the show, but he's in Nashville right now.
Great.
He really has mastered that concept of, is it a bar, is it a restaurant? It's likely somewhere in between. And sometimes he starts off with it being more one than the other. And like you said, he has said to me, you know, the customer dictates what it is.
They do. Yeah, they'll show
totally.
You.
So that'll do it. I want to say, look, this has run long, but thank you, Ian, so much for joining me today. I really appreciate
sure.
it. Where can people find you?
Nola.com is kind of the home base. Go on any social media app of your choice. It's at Ian McNulty Nola, and you can catch up with me there.
Thank you so much.
Well, and pleasure to be on. Thank you.
With that, I'm going to hand it to my daughters to take it away.
New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you do. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.